The following is a North Carolina Baptist resource. For more, visit ncbaptist.org.
My name's Kenny Lamb. I'm the, what am I? I'm the worship and music consultant. I guess if you serve in worship in your church, you ask that question sometimes too. But I'm a worship and music consultant for the Baptist State Convention, North Carolina. And I was excited to have an opportunity to talk about worship and discipleship. I wanted to first just ask you, when you think about discipleship, what do you think people in the church generally think of as far as where that takes place? Sunday school. What?
Coffee shop.
Coffee shops.
Usually they think classroom.
Classroom kind of stuff. Okay. What else?
Small groups.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Oftentimes when we think about real discipleship, it seems like, just like you said, that we think about things like small group situations, maybe triads, which are really popular today in disciple making, one-on-one mentoring, or even the more traditional discipleship classes. And truly, those are all important components of discipleship. But we also think about in the church how we often think of worship and we think of discipleship. It's almost a dichotomy. It's two different things, or maybe even worship, discipleship, and evangelism. But we don't see that those things kind of go together. But when we think about the Great Commission, what is it that Jesus tells us are the two things that we're to do to make disciples? I'll give you a hint. Baptizing and teaching. That's right. And, you know, these find their principal expression in worship, baptizing and teaching. Zach Hicks, in his book Worship Pastor, says, "Christianity through history has always seen the worship service as the principal arena of disciple-making. The essence of being made into a disciple is being formed into the image and likeness of Christ." So when we think about worship, we need to think about it as formative, not entertainment, as sometimes our churches get caught up in, or not primarily an attractional event, but truly as a formative event to disciple people. In James K.A. Smith's book, Desiring the Kingdom, he expands on this concept of worship as formation. He argues for a change of our understanding of the wiring of human beings. His contention is that we are essentially creatures that are driven by what our hearts truly love, our affections, rather than fundamentally thinking creatures that are driven by information, ideas, and arguments. So if we're trying to disciple a person, to formate them, if that's the correct term, that centers more on rightly ordered love, not because belief is unimportant, but because our desires sit much more at the core of who we are, how we're persuaded and changed. So think about what motivates you. Is it more of what you know, or what more you're passionate about and what your heart desires? Smith puts it this way: being a disciple is not primarily a matter of getting the right ideas, doctrines, and beliefs into our head in order to guarantee proper behavior. Rather, it's a matter of being the kind of person who loves rightly. And he argues that worship is a habit-forming pedagogy of desire, whose practices help us aim our heart towards the right end, Christ and His kingdom. So that's what worship should be for us. Our decision-making is deeply rooted in the wanting and desiring parts that Jesus talked about. When He talked about the heart, He talked about how so much of our will, everything we do, is based on our desires, on our passions, on our heart. We are gut and heart-based creatures more than we are head-based intellectuals. We default to rationalizing what we love and want, and not really the other way around. So Hicks puts it this way: corporate worship's elements, practices, structure, and expression all have a shaping effect on us. Now, what I would say to you is, as I look at worship across North Carolina and other places, and we think about it being a formative event, a time that we are making disciples, I think we're really missing the mark in two big ways in making disciples in worship. One is, often we have shallow content. We're going to talk about that a little bit. And second is the level of participation, or maybe I should say the lack of participation in a lot of our worship services. And a lot of our time together is going to be focused on that particular area. But first, I want to focus a little more on content. We have to realize there's no transformation that is possible apart from the gospel. But a lot of times the gospel is somewhat missing from our worship services. We must form people in the gospel by equipping them with the gospel. And in Hick's book, he says, if formation is truly based in the heart and our desires, the gospel alone has the power to initially and perpetually reorient those desires. In this respect, formational practices can only be as formational as they point us to and orient us around Jesus' work in His life, death, and resurrection. So if we think about our services, are they gospel-oriented? They really need to have the three G's of the gospel involved somewhere in the gospel story of our services. The first, I bet most of our churches do pretty well, and that's the glory of God. That's where we want worship to begin, by putting God in all He is and all He has done at center stage. We revel in Him, we worship Him, we adore Him, we celebrate Him. But the second G of the gospel, which is so important, and I think a lot of our churches really miss sight of, is the gravity of sin. God's perfections contrast sharply with our imperfections. If we think about Isaiah in Isaiah 6, when he comes into contact with God and in worship there, what happens? He says, woe is me, I am a sinner. We can't understand grace without a radical encounter with our own sin. Yet today, so often, we just seem to push that aside in our worship services. In our time of worship, we need to have personal confession. We need to have a time of lamenting over our world's brokenness, because grace appears as high as we are brought low. And I think oftentimes we ignore the gravity of sin in our services. But then the next step in the gospel story is the grandeur of grace. We need a moment in worship when we witness the God of this universe dying on the cross, bleeding into death for our sin. We celebrate God's grace in our lives and we respond to the gospel. Now, I encourage you to think back over the services you've had in the last month. Have you been celebrating the glory of God? Have you been experiencing the gravity of sin? Have you been thinking through and expressing the grandeur of grace? We can't truly transform people if we're not really experiencing the changing, transformational gospel in our services. But when we, as worship leaders, begin to think pastorally, we develop a heart and concern for how our people are following Him beyond this weekly time that we gather on Sundays. We're interested in how gathered worship affects and forms people's worship in their day-to-day living. So we have to teach them how to pray, how to repent, how to worship. I think we've often fall short in that. Let's just take a few examples. In the area of prayer, the worship service is a central training ground and a vocabulary builder for Christians' prayers in their own personal lives. The components of our worship services put the words of prayer on the lips of the people. The speech shapes the prayer life, or lack thereof, people the other 6 days. So do we model thoughtful, intentional, passionate, and faithful speech to God? Do we mirror the breadth of the prayers that we see in the Psalms, from things like shouts of joy to tears of shame to moans of lamentation? We want our worship services to be filled with real substantive prayers. Yet I think, and I know this doesn't count for any of your churches, but in many churches I encounter, prayers seem to be fillers to go between a couple of songs, or because we know we need to say a prayer when we take up the offering, or those kinds of things. I've heard them often referred to as just prayers. Or, Father, we just come into Your presence because we just want to thank You. And, you know, there's not a lot of substance to that. And unfortunately, because we're forming the people in our congregations, that's what they see as prayer when they're spending their own personal times with God. And we need to have a richness and a fullness. Our prayers need to be shaped by Scripture, where we're using the Scriptures in our prayers. We need to have the names and attributes of God as we call out who He is and praise Him for who He is and what He has done in our life. We need supplication, confession, and intercession. We've already talked about the need of that in the gospel, that people understand that they need to confess to God what is going on in their lives. We need to experience Christ's return in that day when all things will be made new. We also realize that there is an enemy, and we need to pray that there is an offensive against him in our lives. These are just some of the things we need to make in our richness of prayers. We also realize that music is a huge part of prayers. I like the way Paul Balazs, we had him here last year, and he talked about how our songs are prayers. And the amazing thing about that is it unifies us when we're singing our prayers. It focuses our wandering thoughts. It stirs our passion, and it engages our bodies. So songs are a wonderful tool in our prayers of worship. The other thing I think about is the Bible in worship. You know, we talk as Southern Baptists that we are people of the book, but yet so often the only time we read the book in worship is when the pastor is reading the sermon passage. We need to infuse the Word of God in all of the things we do in our services to lift up the power and the gospel and all that is in there. And then as worship planners, as worship leaders, in many ways we are theological dietitians. I knew this was after lunch, so it wouldn't hurt to see some food on the screen. But we have to be dietitians. Today, I think so often we see in worship, we try to create a feel-good, as somebody told me, described it the other day, a happy, clappy celebration, where our worship is just a celebration and that's all. But if you think about it, what happens when people go through trials, when they go through hard times, when they find out that their spouse has just been diagnosed with incurable cancer, when they lose their job? It seems really contrary to what we teach them and model for them in worship, if everything is happy and celebrative. They aren't equipped to deal with life's pains in the context of their faith. Sometimes they feel like maybe there's something wrong with them because their life should be all celebration and all happy, but suddenly that's not the case in their life, and they don't know how to deal with that. Suffering seems incompatible. Worship never addressed those things. So I ask the question, if all that the people of God had was the worship services that we plan and lead in our churches, what would they know about Him and how would they relate to Him? I think that's a question we as worship leaders, worship planners need to think about over the course of the year as we are those dietitians of sorts in our worship. We must recognize that people in our churches, we need to come to grips with this, for the most part are probably not studying their Bibles much on their own. Nor do a majority of them, unless your church is unusual, take part in discipleship opportunities your church offers. So for many, corporate worship is the only way that they get Christian formation. So worship, not the classroom, not small groups, not triads, not mentoring, is where the Word of God forms every believer's theology. And as a worship leader and worship planner, that's pretty heavy burden, you might say, on our lives to be able to carry that out. We want worship to help people know God, not just know about God. Zach Hicks says that songs are nothing more and nothing less than theology inflamed, engulfing our hearts. Sung worship is one of the most holistic ways we can experience theology because song summons our whole self, our mind, our body, our soul, our intellect, will, and emotions. When we sing about God, His works, and our response to Him, we're being deeply and indelibly theologized. Now, I often use this example. If you were to go up, and I don't suggest you do this, but if you go back to your churches and you just take a few people and take them aside and say, I want to survey you, and ask them to quote every Bible verse they know from memory and make a little list of all that, and then you say, would you sing for me the first verse and chorus of every song you know from memory? Now, which one of those do you think is going to win? Usually by a landslide. Now, what does that say about us as worship leaders and worship planners? That's very important, what we're putting in their heads, isn't it? When people walk away from a worship service, usually they carry with them more than anything else the songs. And for you senior pastors, that's not to put down preaching in the least. But realize, you know, weeks from now, months from now, years from now, they're going to probably remember those songs, but they may not remember the 3 points of your sermon outline from 2 months ago. The songs have the most prolonged digestion rate. Their theology is slow release. They stick, they haunt, and preach. So the question is, what are the songs preaching to our people? Do we take that diet seriously? So I would say go back and look at the last few months of worship services in your church and look at every song and think about, what is it are we teaching the people through these songs? We need to be familiar with old songs. We need to be familiar with new songs. We must be in touch with the hurts, the needs, the dreams, the aspirations of our church. And we need to carefully consider what people want compared with what they need. If you think about a dietitian, they know how to work in a little comfort food along with food that is good for the people. And I'm afraid that sometimes in our worship services, we're creating diabetics and people with high blood pressure because we're giving them just what they want and not what they truly need. But as worship pastors, as worship planners, as whatever your position is in that, it's so important that we look at what do they need. And when we think about the songs, some questions we should ask, for instance, are, is it theologically precise? Now, I would think that's an understood question that we should always put a song through filters, but we realize that there's a number of popular songs today that come out of a different tradition, perhaps, that has a very different theology from what our churches have. We have to be very careful that just because it's a hit we hear on the radio every time we turn it on, or the church down the street's doing it, is it truly something that we want to put in the hearts and the minds of our people, informing them into little Christ? And then number two, is it understandable? I remember, and I can't remember the song, but it was on Facebook several years ago, some worship leaders were debating a fairly new song, and they said, in the second verse, that second line, I think it means this. And then another worship leader said, no, it means this. Another one said, no, it means this. And I just wanted to scream, if you don't know what it means, why are you giving this to your people? And it has to be understandable, and it has to line up theologically with us. And is it aimed Godward? Now, yes, as we see in the Psalms, sometimes we sing that we or I, but still it's aimed towards God in what we do. So we want to make sure our songs are aimed Godwards. And as I mentioned, it needs to be in line with the gospel. We need to be proclaiming the gospel in our times of singing. And then we look at the music. Does the music complement the lyrics? Is it singable? We're going to talk about that more. How do we introduce new songs? We're going to talk about that more in just a moment. Let me just ask, how many of you are musician worship leaders in your church? Would you raise your hand? How many of you are senior pastors that maybe don't lead the music? Bless y'all. Why were you slow in raising your hands? Are you afraid we're going to attack you or something? We love pastors, okay? Thank you for coming. Well, let me mark out this next part. No. Just kidding. Just kidding. Okay, let's get serious. To be totally honest, I believe that in many of our churches, we have a toxic culture where worship is being transformed into a spectator event rather than true worship. If our people are not actively participating in the songs of worship, I think we're losing that tremendous formative event that we're talking about, this formative effect, where it involves our wills, our emotions, our intellects, and our bodies in singing the songs. When we pour this theology into them, we pour this shaping of their hearts and helping them sing these songs, if they merely stand back and watch, it's not going to be that kind of formation that we're talking about. So first I want to talk a little bit about content. Now I want to get into participation. And for those of you that are not musical, some of these parts may seem a little musical for you. But I think it will help to understand all this. A few years ago, I wrote an article called 9 Reasons People Aren't Singing in Worship. You may have seen that on Facebook or somewhere. But really what this gets at is some problems I have seen happening in churches. Simply put, I think we're breeding a culture of spectators in our churches, changing what should be a participative worship environment to a concert event. Unfortunately, I think a lot of times this is done unknowingly by worship leaders that have very good intentions. They just don't realize what it is they're doing. And a lot of that is because we have some very poor models in the world around us to look at. So I think what's foundational in this is what we see is our role as a worship leader. Is our role as a worship leader to present a wonderful presentation on stage, to sound the most incredible we can, to come closest to the recordings that we hear on the radio? Or is it to help our people to worship, to enable them with their voices, to voice their praise, their worship for God, to sing these great songs of theology? And I would say to you that that second one is the one that we should be aiming for. But a lot of times we seem misdirected on the other. So I want us to look at some of the things that we do. Sometimes, like I say, we don't really think about it, but we do this and it is hurting our congregations. Number one, a lot of times our congregations don't know the songs. And I'm going to just read the little blurb that I wrote there, and then I'm going to do some explanation. With the release of new songs weekly and the increased birthing of locally written songs, worship leaders are providing a steady diet of the latest, greatest worship songs. Indeed, we should be singing new songs, but too high a rate of new song inclusion in worship can kill our participation rate and turn the congregation into spectators. I visited a church a few years back that I was told had the most incredible worship service. I just really need to go there. So I went there that morning, and indeed, their band was wonderful. They sang wonderfully, they played wonderfully, and I was just amazed at their professionalism. But as I looked around at the congregation, no one was singing. They were just all standing there watching what was going on stage, and I thought, you know, there's a problem here. And as I started investigating later, I found out of the 7 songs they sang that day, 5 of those songs had never been sung in that church before. Now, I would say, I call songs our worship vocabulary, the songs that we know we can worship best with. Now, I strongly believe we need to be singing new songs and songs of this decade and all of that. But so often what we do is we interject these new songs. People take their eyes off of God trying to get the notes, the rhythms, and all that right, and it hurts our worship. It causes a non-participation to a certain level. So we need to sing songs they know, but what's important here is when we introduce new songs, how many should we sing? Now, I thought we would go and ask Siri. Siri, do you talk to Siri? I do this all the time. Siri, how many new songs should we sing in our worship service? Never introduce more than 1 new song in a worship service. Okay. Never. Okay. Siri does have an attitude every once in a while. This isn't just my observation, but studies and talking with a lot of people, it seems like when we introduce more than 1 new song in a worship service, it begins to really hurt the participation overall in our times of worship. When I do worship leader boot camps and go through all this stuff in a lot more detail with worship leaders, there's 2 things I have them do, and this is one of them. I have them, and I'm not going to make you do that today, but I encourage you to come to one of these trainings, and I'll make you do it there, is raise your right hand and repeat after me that you'll never introduce more than 1 new song in a worship service. I really believe this is one of the 2 things that is probably, of the 9 reasons, is the 2 worst things that we as worship leaders do, is introduce too many of those. And the other question is, well, if we can introduce 1 new song, how many new songs can we introduce in a month? Well, if your church hasn't sung a new song since Bill Gaither's Because He Lives, you probably don't want to introduce them too fast. You know, sometimes 1 a month, maybe 1 every 3 weeks may be fine. We're going to talk about some other things that are going to weigh in on that after a while. But it's not so much the frequency, but the introduction and the reinforcement of new songs. So I want to talk about that for a minute, because this is where we're not always sure how do we introduce these new songs to really help our people to gather them. And I'm going to go through this very fast. You'll notice in your notes, a lot of places I have URLs like klam.us/something. That's where, if anything I'm going over, you'll find more details on a web page I've created about that. So if I go too fast with it, you can digest it later in that way. But first of all, our people are not really caught up in worship necessarily. They've come in with all kinds of junk going on in their lives. Maybe their kids are screaming when they left them in the nursery and they're not ready to be intimate with God. And we come into worship service, we sing the new song right at the very beginning. They struggle with it a little bit. We move on to songs they know well, and that doesn't hurt the flow of worship. Or maybe even have a little rehearsal where we come out before church worship time starts and just have almost like a choir rehearsal with the congregation. This is a song we're going to be singing later in the service. The new song needs to be played several weeks in a row, and I think this is a problem that we so often do. We'll introduce a new song this week, and then we'll wait and 2 months later bring that song back, and it's like a new song again. So what I really encourage you to do is to sing it 3 weeks in a row, lay off a week, sing it another week, and by that time, your people really know it. I saw this so clearly. I was doing an interim in a church. I'm starting to talk faster, I know. But I was doing an interim in a church just last year, and it was an older congregation, and we just introduced... you'll come to me in a minute. We introduced a fairly new worship song, and we were singing that the first Sunday, and they were just, you know, so-so. The second Sunday, they just really began to catch on. The third Sunday, what absolutely amazed me, I looked out, and there was a senior adult man standing with his walker with the oxygen tube going up his nose, and he was singing for all he was worth and clapping his hands. And I thought, That is something else. And it was just amazing how worship on that song, which was led by a praise band in a predominantly senior adult congregation, was catching on. And a lot of that was because we had sung it 3 weeks in a row. They'd begun to make it a part of their worship life, and it was so good to do that. So we need to repeat those songs several weeks in a row. Lay off, bring it back a week, then you can use it in your regular rotation. If you have small groups, men's groups, ladies' groups, or groups to meet in homes that have worship times, introduce those new songs there. More people that know the song when it comes into worship, the more it will take on. Introduce as presentational music. If you have a choir, the choir could sing it this week. Maybe have them join in on the chorus next week. We sing as a congregational song. Vocal team, any soloists, those kinds of things. Play a recording of the new songs before the service. I had a church that I was working with, and they had planned 10 great multi-generational contemporary worship songs they were going to be introducing in the next months. And we made a recording of that they played in worship as people came in every week. So kind of by osmosis, people began to learn those songs before we sang them in worship. And what I'm going to talk about a little more in a moment is create a web page of upcoming new songs. I think it's very important that we help our people to prepare in their personal times of worship for our corporate times of worship. And this is one way that has great benefits for both. Create a CD of new songs for distribution. Now, you do need licensing permission, which is not terribly difficult to do this. But I was working with a church that was trying to transform and to sing a lot more modern worship songs. They produced 2 CDs, 10 songs each, put it in the hands of everybody in their church and said, we want you to listen to this when you're driving around in your car, when you're washing dishes, whatever you're doing. And it was amazing how quickly we could start introducing newer songs in our congregation because people were doing that. Yes.
I think we're good at giving the words of the new songs because we got all these high projections. Do you think there's enough people who these days who can read music that we should be making the actual notes of the music available to people too?
That's a great question. Do we have another question? I've not personally taken surveys, but people I've heard talk about say that they're really... musical literacy is not that high as we like to think it is. And honestly, I did when I was in church years ago, when we started moving from a more traditional to a more contemporary type of thing, screens and all that, we went both ways for a while where we had hymnals, if it was in the hymnal or some other way with music and words on screen, and people could choose. After about 3 months, I had 2 people in the congregation that still used the music. Everybody else was looking at the screen, and they had a choice at that point. Do you have anything valuable to say? Yes, sir.
I was
going
to say, instead of CDs, you could also create playlists on Spotify or
yes.
on Prime.
Yeah,
just
yeah.
tell people, go and download this playlist.
Yes, excellent. And that kind of gets into, thank you for segueing wonderfully into that, Jonathan. Creating a weekly worship guide, including new songs. Now, I think a huge thing for us as worship leader is preparing our congregation for our times of corporate worship. So how can we do that? We can create content, and we'll talk about how to get that content out, but there's a lot of stuff we can do other than just the new songs. For instance, sermon preparation. If our pastor can give us information about the sermon coming up that he wants the people in their church and their family times of worship and their personal times of worship to begin thinking about in the sermon, this is a great time to help prepare their hearts to be fertile soil for the sermon that is coming up. So you could have sermon prep. You could have prayer points. And this isn't talking about Sister Mary's cousin's brother's cat's veterinarian's hernia, but this is more... kingdom prayer points. You know, pray for our worship leaders that they would get pride out of the way as they lead worship. Pray for our, you know, all these kinds of things that will help in the time of worship. And then songs for worship. I like to include every song that is going to be sung, whether it's a older traditional song, maybe in a contemporary setting, or more modern worship song. I like all of that to be included. And again, we'll talk about that in a moment, how we do that. And then a follow-up. Maybe the pastor would take something from his sermon that he left the people with to think about that sermon in the past. So he's going to put some questions out that helps their family to think about the sermon and some next steps they can take in their own life. So that's a way that you can move into the family worship times, move into personal worship times, a connection with the corporate worship time, and I think you'll see benefits in both places. And then family worship cues. If you use certain of the Lifeway products where children and adults are all studying the same thing. You know their family worship cues that come in that you can print. Or you as a staff can come together with some things that you think would be helpful for the families to talk about that fits with what you're teaching in your churches today. But once you have the content, how do you distribute it? There's a lot of different ways you can do that. And I personally prefer online content, unless you're dealing with a congregation that's not online. And you know, we all have some of those people, and maybe you need to make provisions for those. But for instance, the church that I was entering in recently, we created a web page that basically had all of this information on it. And you would go there, and we embedded YouTube videos with lyrics of every song, so they could go there ahead of time and click on it. They would hear the song. They would see the lyrics. You can do Spotify playlists, you know, all those kinds of things. If it's online, you can include the sermon information. All of that stuff is very easy content. Then you can push that out through your Facebook page, through Twitter, through email. You can embed new songs in Facebook, and, you know, little teasers of different things, and pushing people to this page. There's so much you can do, and on a very, very, very low budget. It's essentially free to do that kind of thing. You can do a downloadable, printable page if you need to put something in the hands of people who can't go online. You could do something with that. As I mentioned, email, social media, and then a printed handout. But all of those things, as you start thinking about it, if you'd follow that URL I have there, I have a little more detail of that along with some examples that'll help you with some of those ideas. But I need to move on because our time moves on. I want to move on to number two of reasons we aren't singing in worship. We're singing songs not suitable for congregational singing. There are lots of great new worship songs today, but in the vast pools of new songs, many are not suitable for congregational singing by virtue of their rhythms, too difficult for the average singer, or, listen, too wide of a range. Consider the average singer, and we're going to talk about that a little bit more in a moment, not the vocal superstar that might be on the stage of your church or on the recording that we listen to. Range is too wide. We have a lot of modern worship songs today that have come out with more than two octaves in range, and very few of your normal people can sing a two-octave range. And when we think about the congregation, we think of normal people. Also, there's a lot of songs you would hear on K-Love that are just not suitable for a worship song. They might be a great testimonial song. It might be great for some other things, but they're not suitable for congregation by just what their lyrics are. Now, this kind of segues into the next point, but I've asked Tim Hawkins to come and help introduce this for me.
Have any worship pastors here tonight that do a lot of the worship music or the modern worship stuff? I think that's great. I just have a few requests for you. And I think I'm speaking for a lot of people here tonight. I'm just trying to help, okay? I have three requests, worship pastor. First request is, it's Sunday morning. It's really early. A lot of us have not had breakfast. Can you one time in our life pick a song with a key we can sing in just one time? Something that a normal human can latch on to, Chris Tomlin. Can you do that, please? I'm not Barry White. I'm not a BG. Can you pick something in the middle? I can't. I'm going to faint right now.
Okay, thank you for that. That's a nice segue into number three. We are singing in keys too high for the average singer. The people we're leading in worship generally have a limited range, do not have a high range. When we pitch songs in keys that are too high, the congregation will stop singing, tire out, eventually quit, becoming spectators. Remember, our responsibility is to enable the congregation to sing their praises, not to showcase our great platform voices by pitching songs in our power ranges. The basic range of the average singer is an octave and a fourth from A to D with occasional E flat. Yes, sir. There are times that it is that case. Most of the sin I see is high. Yes, sir.
When I've addressed this on occasion with other worship leaders, I generally, and I think there's some validity to this, if you want to throw it out, I think that when there's a female lead singer, she'll argue that if it's a guy's song, mm-hmm. the key doesn't work for her. Mm-hmm. And the same thing, vice versa. If it's a guy singing a song typically sung by a female, mm-hmm. there needs to be key adjustment with that. Because I've been told.
So are you suggesting on girl songs that guys don't sing?
Well, like for example.
And the guy's songs that girls don't sing.
Like if I'm singing a song that's currently popular by a female lead singer, uh-huh. I'm generally not going to sing it in the key she did it because it will be too high for me.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is we should compromise and sing where everybody can sing.
Yeah, exactly. But how do you get somebody who's like, let's say I have a female lead singer and she's like, well, I can't sing those keys. Mm-hmm. They're too low for me, you mm-hmm. know? It's not necessarily true, but that's in your mind. Mm-hmm. How do you gently...
The mind's a dangerous place. let me follow up this argument here, and then we can maybe come back to that. But I hear that a lot. But the sweet spot, if you took music theory and learned soprano, alto, tenor, bass, all that stuff, the sweet spot where most every voice can sing is middle C to high C on lady range, octave lower for guy range. Okay. Tenors, basses, sopranos, altos can all sing roughly in that. That falls in their supposed range. Now, the problem is the majority of our songs are more than an octave, but some are an octave. Like How Great Is Our God is under an octave, and you can sing it in all kinds of keys if you technically wanted to by letter of the law. But others are greater than that. So in that, and this is a commonly held thing, I've read this in songwriting for Christian songbooks and talking with a lot of people, A to D, and maybe even fudge up to a B flat, what you want to try to do is get it closer to that C to C range as you can. A to D, when I say occasional E flat, you don't want to stay up there to have a high tessitura, but you know, maybe occasionally bump up there, but for the most part, you want to be right in that range. Now, I tell you what, rather than we argue about it, let's do this. Let's all sing, okay? Everybody sings. We're in worship. You sing. You don't have to be a vocalist. Sorry about the company. It's kind of corny, but it's best I can find. We're not ready to sing. This is an introduction. Here we go. I'll bring you in. My Jesus, my Savior, Lord, there is none like you. All of my days I want to praise the wonders of your mighty love. My comfort, my shelter, tower of refuge and strength, okay. You did right well hanging in there, actually. I think we got a lot of high voice folks in here. Okay. Now, here's the part, if you don't read music, just hang with me for a moment. This is what we did. We sang Shout to the Lord in key of E flat. Now, this is, all this grunting, we sing a lot of songs much higher than this in our worship time. But this was, we're singing, this wasn't an occasional E flat. You see it several times. And then, worship you! And then where it really splatted all over the walls and slung down was on this G, praise to the King. Now, if we just looked at that song and put it in a congregationally friendly key, for instance, the key of B flat or the key of B, which are the only two keys that fit the letter of the law, the low notes of A, then you've got these B flats here, and then when you get to the screechy note, it's just a D, which is fine. And, whoops. Didn't mean to go there yet. But that's the way you said it. Okay, I will go there. Now let's get real personal. 10,000 Reasons, sung all over the world, one of the most popular songs. It was number one CCLI list for months and months and months and months and months and months. Its original key is key of G. I go into churches often and sing this in the key of G. Well, maybe I don't sing it, but they're playing it in the key of G. Look at this. There's a lot of E's, which are higher than an occasional E flat, that you see in that. Yes, there we are. And the low note is a D. Now, what it should be in, the highest acceptable key, is an E. And it's in the key of E. And you'll see here, high note is a D. Low note is a B. Yes, thank you, D sharp. Or occasional E flat in sheep's clothing. Okay, or a B natural right there. This is the song we were singing at the church. I was talking about where the man on the walker was just going to it. This is Amazing Grace. I have sung this in churches in the key of B flat. Now, every head bowed, every eye closed. Would you raise your hand if you need to confess? Okay. In the key of B flat. Now, look how high this is for congregations. Suitable congregational key is key of F. You have a lot of C's. It's still up there in the strong power range of the average singer, so it still has that energy that it needs to have. There it is in E flat, which is another good key for that. This doesn't have a huge range, so you can move it down there, and it's very acceptable. Now, before you get all fretting and stuff about trying to figure this out for all the songs, I've done this for about 170 songs. If you go to bestkeys.com, you'll find it's, what I did, it takes the 100 top CCLI songs, and every time that changes, I just add the new songs in, so it's about up to 170 right now. And you will find the song, for instance, This is Amazing Grace. Its acceptable keys are the key of E-flat, the key of E, and the key of F. The good news is LifewayWorship.com almost always, 99.8% of the time, puts things in congregational keys, and you'll see that here. They put this in E-flat and F. Also, another thing I'll just throw in about Lifeway Worship, some of these songs that have ranges that are too wide, like a two-octave thing, have rearranged it in a way that you can use it that doesn't go the two octaves. So I always look there for my source. Now, I said there's two things I always have people pledge to do, and if you were my worship leaders in a class, I would have you now raise your right hand and say you'll never sing a song outside the single range of congregational song of A to D with an occasional E-flat. So back to your argument, girls and boys singing. And yes, it seems like lower songs, female voices tend to like to sing those better, and guy voices. But I would say, you know, that may be true of your platform people, but we still want to make sure whoever's leading it is leading it in a range that's acceptable to everybody. Yeah. And so, you know, who leads it, a lady or a guy, it doesn't matter. Whichever sounds better, that's fine, but we want to make sure the congregation is finding accessibility to that. Yes.
One tool that I found pretty useful is on praisecharts.com.
Uh-huh.
There's a keyboard function there, and it kind of shows you, actually gives you a keyboard with the range of the song.
Super.
On.
Okay.
And whenever you start getting up to the E flat, mm-hmm. F area, it goes into like a yellow color.
Then I like that. I have not seen that. Thank you. I was going to caution, if you use praisecharts.com, they always have the original keys, but they have alternate keys. Make sure, I didn't realize they had that feature now, make sure you check it so you use the right key when you do that. That's the good thing about Lifeway Worship is they already vet that for you. But that's great to know. Thank you. Our role as worship leaders is to enable the congregation to sing, not to put on a great performance. There is a fine line between absolute excellence and moving too far into calling attention to our sales performance. We'll talk about that more in a moment. Number four, the congregation can't hear people around them singing. If our music is too loud for people to hear each other singing, it is too loud. Let me pause there. Congregational worship should be congregational. Is that profound? Which means we should be aware that there are other people other than ourselves there. If the music is so loud we can't hear ourselves singing, let alone people around us singing, it doesn't feel congregational. I'll say that, all that right now.
If the music is too loud and you're trying to sing, you go up to the after the service is over, not during service, and say, can you tone your music down or turn the amp style a little bit or something?
Ask them to come to one of my conferences and I'll handle it, okay? The problem with that is... Yeah, that's part of it. Yes. But where I caution you there is I have run sound before and my decibel level was way, way in range of not being too loud. And I'll have people come and say, oh, it's just too loud.
Yeah, I'm thinking your sound booth maybe back at the church. Uh-huh. All the way at the back and you've got speakers at the back of our church.
That's something that, are you the worship guy at your church?
I'm just there. I like to sing. But
uh-huh. Talk to your... It's best to go through, right? Don't talk to your sound guy. Talk to your worship guy and voice your concern and let him or her examine what it is and then talk to the sound. Because sound people don't need everybody going to them. They don't answer to everybody. They answer to a higher authority.
Pastors.
Pastors.
I'm glad you said that, because I go a lot of places and I feel like if I scream, I couldn't hear myself.
Yes.
And I don't feel like I'm involved.
I was at one church that passed out earplugs as you came in if you wanted them. And I was at, and I went on a website and they said, we play our music loud, and they tell about how many decibels, and they even say that OSHA says if you're not exposed to this for more than 45 minutes, there will not be permanent hearing loss. And if you don't want it that loud, here are earplugs. I think that's bad stewardship. That also cuts the congregational part out. More on that later. But the second part of this is, conversely, if the music is too quiet, generally congregation will fail to sing out with power. Find the right balance, strong but overbearing. I was in a church some time ago, and the music was so quiet, I started singing. I don't think my voice is that unpleasant, but people turned around to look at me because it was, you just stood out and you didn't feel congregational, felt alone, and there wasn't anything to support it. So that's also the other side of that coin. So we want to make sure that it's good and strong, but it is not invasive. Yes, sir.
We're having some issues actually with the quieter side because the speaker points right at the sound booth.
Uh-huh.
Is there a decibel level that is a good range that you can tell us?
A lot of, nice you mentioned that. I've got an article, klam.us/howloud, from another authority. I'm not an authority on that issue, but a lot of things I've read said around 85-ish is a good place. I think that's where Disney runs a lot of their strong productions that you go in and feel like are really strong and professional, but it's not into hearing loss kind of stuff. And a lot, too, when you start talking about things, gets into equalization of your room. You may have some frequencies that are popping too loud, and your decibel level is fine, but it's killing people with that. There's a lot of issues in that.
Hey, Kenny, I was going to throw out, one of our sound techs showed me, there are free apps you can download,
yes,
that are decibel meters.
Mm-hmm.
The sound guy can sit in the booth and hold up the app and just literally watch,
thank you,
what's peaking, what's about the feedback, how loud, mm-hmm, is it.
Excellent.
Then you know how to use it.
Good point.
You can get instantaneous. You can get instantaneous,
yes,
readings, and you can get average readings.
Yes.
And if you base it on instantaneous readings, then you're looking at something totally different. Plus, what Kenny was talking about, if the EQ in your room is not right, you can run at 85 with a bad EQ and,
yeah,
it'd be painful, and run,
that's
at,
right,
95 with a good EQ and nobody complains.
Yeah, exactly. So. Thank you. That's another whole course. Number five, we have created worship services that are spectator events, building a performance environment. Okay, I don't want anybody to get upset with me about this because, well, let me just read this. I'm a strong advocate of setting a great environment for worship, including lighting, visuals, inclusion of the arts, and much more. However, when our environments take things to a level that calls undue attention to those on stage or distracts from our worship of God, we have gone too far. Excellent, yes. Highly professional performance, no. I was in a... Okay, tell me, is this worship or concert? Meh. Well, maybe yes, but I visited a church. It was out of state, so I can talk about it. And we went to this one service, and it was their contemporary service, and it looked very much like this. And the people were up on stage. Everything was done with IMAG, so you could see the people in the big screens and everything. And it was interesting to me because when I really realized they were thinking of it as a performance is when the camera person was up on stage doing close-ups, the guitar player is just playing along, and when he saw himself on the big screen, he jumped down and started doing all kinds of gyrations and these kinds of things. But I'm going to address some of these issues a little more later, but you know, setting an environment, a proper environment, using lighting, using, you know, all of those kinds of tools that we have to us can be very meaningful in our times of worship. But when we start making it where the congregation is so diminished, the people on stage are so brought out, and it's becoming all about them, then we've gone too far. We are like butlers. We're enabling our people to worship. We're not the main show. More on that a little bit later. Number six, the congregation feels they're not expected to sing. As worship leaders, we often get so involved in our professional production of worship that we fail to be authentic, invite the congregation to the journey of worship, do all we can to facilitate the experience in singing familiar songs, new songs introduced properly, and all sung in the proper congregational range. I had an example. I had somebody ask me the other day on an elevator somewhere, said, can you tell me if I was supposed to be singing yesterday in worship? I said, surely you were supposed to sing in worship. So this is what happens. Our group is normally led by, we have a male worship pastor, and he normally leads the singing. But this particular song, a lady was leading the singing, which is a great thing to change up the textures and the sounds and all that and let her lead out. But he said, I was confused if I was supposed to be singing or not. He said the words were on the screen, but the rest of the vocal team, while she was singing, held their microphones and stood like this and watched her sing. Now, what does that communicate to the people? They were supposed to stand and watch her sing. She's performing this song. Now, my guess is that they probably intended for the congregation to be singing then. So in a situation like that, when I'm working with a team, I say, okay, pull your mics down, but sing the song, engage the congregation just as you do if your mics are up, so they understand that. And if there's any doubt as you start singing, people don't seem to be involved, you know, say, sing with me, or, you know, encourage them in some ways. But so often what we do, maybe we don't realize it, what we do does not encourage them to sing, and they just sit back and become spectators. Number seven, we fail to have a common body of hymnody. With availability of so many new songs, we often become haphazard in our worship planning, pulling songs from so many sources without reinforcing the songs and helping congregations to take them on as a regular expression of their worship. In the old days, the hymnal was that repository. Y'all remember what those look like? Okay. Today, we need to create song lists to use in planning our times of worship. Let me camp out here just a little bit. In the old days, I remember the old days, I had a hymnal, and I used it when I planned worship. You know, you had all those great indices, like indices, whatever those things are in the back, that would help you plan. And I've seen people that, you know, you would turn to Leaning on the Everlasting Arms, and there's little in pencil written every date that that was sung, so you knew kind of when it was sung before. But all your planning was done there. The nice thing about that was your Southern Baptist Convention already put it through all those filters of theology to make sure it's good and sound, and so it was all safe. That's not the case today. We have a hymnal, and our most recent hymnal, by the way, is the bestseller of all times. Can you believe that? No hymnal was sold any better than the most recent hymnal. But we have Lifeway Worship, Praise Charts, Song Select, sources just all over the world that we can draw in modern hymns, modern worship songs. And so today we've gotten a little bit of a frenzy in that we choose songs from all around, hopefully putting them through those filters. But this is one thing I might be chasing a rabbit here that concerns me is if every church decides what of this mass group they're going to use and they choose a lot of obscure songs that aren't very popular. In our mobile society today, let's say if we're in your church and we sing this particular body of songs that isn't really shared by a lot of other churches, and then in a few years I move to go take another job, and then those churches are singing a total different repertoire, then I'm going to be really behind in learning those songs because you won't be repeating them like you do a new song. So it's going to be rough on me. What I'm saying is to try to catch that vision of the church universal, if we will use songs that are more commonly held by our folks, and that's where you can go to things like the CCLI list, and that doesn't mean every song on the CCLI list is any good. A lot of them are, but they've been tried and proven. But those are songs that are more commonly known by other churches. Now, yes, you might have some locally written songs or some other songs that fit just perfectly with something that is emphasis or a need in your church. But I'm just saying that we need to have something of a commonality that still holds us together as a faith community. And also, when we plan worship, I encourage worship leaders now to use lists of songs, knowing what their congregation knows and knowing what new songs they're adding to that. That gets into a lot more of a lot more information that we'll not go into today. But we need to have something of a common body of hymnody. Number eight, worship leaders ad lib too much. Keep the melody clear and strong. The congregation is made up of sheep with limited ranges and limited musical ability. When we stray from that melody to ad-lib, the sheep try to follow us, end up frustrated, and quit singing. Some ad-lib is nice and can enhance worship, but don't let it lead your sheep astray. Maybe I shouldn't use the sheep analogy in there, but most of our congregation is going to follow that lead vocal very strongly. And if you start painting a different picture that sounds pretty, that's not the melody, a lot of times your congregation is going to quit singing the melody and try to do what you're doing. They won't be able to do it, and they will just quit. And I used to, before, a few months ago, I used to say, okay, worship leaders, if you're singing a song, everybody knows, like, How Great Is Our God. They know that really strongly. It's not going to hurt if you ad-lib a little bit. And I was in a house church in China that was actually about 150 people together, and they were singing How Great Is Our God, except, for, of course, they were singing it in Chinese. And the worship leader started ad-libbing, and I've never experienced worship like I have in China. It's just so strong, but I was shocked because the people got all confused and started trying to sing with the worship leader, and it messed up things. And so now I'm not sure that even well-known songs we can do that. You know, maybe somebody else in your worship team can do something as long as the melody is still strong and pure in there to help keep them in tune with what they need to sing. And then, number nine, worship leaders are not connecting with the congregation. I want to go at this two ways. We often get caught up in our world of amazing music production and lose sight of a purpose of helping the congregation to voice their worship. Let them know you expect them to sing. Quote the Bible to promote their expressions of worship. Stay alert to how well the congregation is tracking with you, and alter course as needed. Okay, two aspects. I want to look at an on-stage and an off-stage aspect. First, we'll start with on-stage. As worship leaders today, with all the great technologies we have, you know, we can get into using in-ear monitors, which helps our sound a lot, helps us keep control of that, helps us hear things we need to well. We have bright lights that sometimes we dim the lights in the congregation so much that we, you know, they could walk out and we not even know because it is just so bright on us, which is not a good environment. The in-ear monitors could be such that we don't hear the, now I know you can put congregation in those, but a lot of times we don't have that. We don't hear what's going on there. We only hear what's going on stage. So we can pretty much isolate ourselves. We don't see them. We don't hear them. We aren't connecting with them. And we are guides in worship. We need to be staying plugged into them and know what's going on with them as we are singing, as we're worshiping, so we can alter course midway if we need to. So that's one aspect of it, on stage. But then the other thing is off stage. We as worship leaders need to have discipling relationships. We need to share life with our people, which is different from what I see in a lot of places where those that lead worship never seem to connect with the people in the congregation. You know, they come from the green room, go in, do their thing, and then they go. I've seen some that actually leave the sanctuary, and then they come back later. But there's never any connection between them and the people they're leading in worship. And I would say to you, it's going to make more of a performance kind of environment if they see you as a high and lifted up separate entity than them. They want to feel you as part of them that has just come up to help them in their times of worship. So that means, you know, doing life with them, having relationship with them. Maybe even some Sunday mornings, if you have some time, get out and mingle with the people so they feel like you're part of them and you're connecting with them. We're going to talk about discipling relationships in a moment. But trying to stay connected with the congregation, both on stage and off stage, is a huge part to help us shape their lives. Now, I want to talk to you about a few resources, and then I want to talk a little bit as our time remains with about some discipling relationships. First of all, you've seen down at the bottom of this, renewingworshipnc.org. That's the worship blog for North Carolina Baptist. You'll find a lot of articles about some of the things we've talked about, a lot of helpful resources, whether you're looking for a of course, none of you are looking for new worship pastors. If you're looking for a new position as a worship pastor, we have ways to help you with that too. But a lot of things in helping you become more participative in your worship. Also, our chief leadership in helping our worship leaders across the state, our worship leader boot camps. This year we have five different boot camps. The one that I really strongly recommend is a three-day retreat. We actually have one going this Thursday, and because we've had a couple people back out, if any of you want to come to this, it's normally $235, which pretty much covers Caraway's expenses. You can come for $145. That's this Thursday, Friday, and Saturday from lunch Thursday through Saturday afternoon. But those are three-day events that we have no more than 12 worship leaders that we dig in really deeply into a lot of things about what it means to be a worship leader, how to do that in a better way. It's not anything about how to play a guitar or play drums. It's more about understanding what it means to be a worship leader and how to help our congregations to truly worship. We have another one of those coming up in June. We've got a Worship Leader Boot Camp Plus, which is a Friday night, Saturday thing. This is one you bring your teams to. We go through a lot of the same material, not as in much depth as an extreme. We have a live band there to lead times of worship. It's a lot more inspirational than some of our other things. We're also launching some online possibilities. One, a 12-week class that you interact with the students, and we go through the same things that we go through with Extreme with more projects and that type of thing. The Extreme is the three-day retreat. And you'll see in your handout there's some information about all of those. If you go to the website, worshipleaderbootcamp.org, it will explain the five different kinds. But that's the one I really encourage to come to. Like I say, it's no more than 12 worship leaders that we gather together and we just do life for Thursday, Friday, and Saturday to go deep in that. If you've got worship leaders particularly that may be more traditional in some ways and you're trying to help them move to some more contemporary, modern types of worship, this can be helpful for them as well to retool in those ways. I have a list of recommended worship books that's on the very front page in a blue box, I think, on the bottom right. There's 10 books which I think are the very best books to read on worship. I'd encourage you to be digging into some of those books. Also, if you do not receive our weekly worship email, klam.us/enews, you can go and sign up for that. It'll keep you abreast of all the things coming up with events, what comes out each week in the blog article, and those types of issues. Any quick questions before I go into something about building disciple-making worship and music ministry more in the relationship thing? But, yes, sir.
If the worship leader wants to share a story, like she read a devotional or read a book or something mm-hmm. like that, do you have any tips on length and you know, should they always try to be a heartfelt kind of thing, or should they always be exciting, or should they be mixed up, different things like that? I know nobody wants to hear a sermonette,
yeah.
But is, you know, the worship leader at our church, you know, I'll confession out, you know, it's my wife. So I just tell her, honey, you do whatever you want to do.
Of course you do. that is the correct answer.
She'll come to me and she'll say, I'm trying to edit something, but, you know, it might be 90 seconds or 2 minutes.
Yeah.
Is that too long? And I don't know the answer.
Yeah. I generally tell worship leaders that it's probably too long, whatever you do. it's appropriate times, but I think a lot of times we just fill time with words that don't help what we're doing. When the songs could be enough. I usually say infuse with scripture as much as possible if you're going to say something. As we talked about, we don't have enough Bible in our services. There are appropriate times, but I think too often we get verbose and do too much of that.
Okay. Mm-hmm. This may be a question that you can't really entertain, but it can be helpful. So if you have somebody in your worship team that you've kind of sat down, you talk with them, you feel like they're kind of performing for themselves. It's not really that they're leading the congregation
uh-huh.
in worship,
mm-hmm.
but it's they have talent, they, you know, they have the credentials, but they're not, you feel like they're not up there for the right reasons. Is there a process that you would recommend mm-hmm. walking through that or going about something
mm-hmm.
like that?
Just turn to my
call. I've heard some worship pastors, wise ones, that have sat down and talked with them and basically relieved them of doing that until they felt like they could worship on their as a person in the congregation as fully as they do on stage. A lot of that, I think, is going to be education of maybe helping all your people understand what it means to be a worship leader and help them explore, is this what's happening in your life or are there some other things? But that is a hard situation. Yeah.
Yeah. just like to offer a suggestion based on my experience. One of the things that I've used in that type of situation in the past is appeal to them as a member of the team to fulfill a need that's outside of their desire. So if their desire is to be the lead singer and they want to be visible that way, and you say, hey, you're a great lead singer, I really need some support on harmonies right now. Would you be willing to help some other folks on the team learn harmonies to these songs each week and just sit back from leading right now? What you will expose is that asking them to do something that is not their preference will expose their heart as to why they're doing what they're doing. And when that comes out, they will either bow out on their own, or it will open up a discussion where you can say, I sense that maybe your uneasiness is because you're more interested in leading than you are in worshiping. And so that's something that I've done.
That's good. By the way, if any of you do have interest in this, if you'll see me right afterwards, I can talk with you about that. Let me just quickly, on the last pages there, I've got something called Building a Disciple Making Worship and Music Ministry. Just want to hit a few highlights. As we already talked about, music is one of the greatest tools in discipleship. And hopefully you understand that as we talk about how we're helping form people. And it's so important to look at our content. It's so important to help us increase the participation of our people. A disciple must first embrace a lifestyle characterized by regular, consistent, private worship. So we as worship leaders need to first have a lifestyle of worship. I believe we can't lead people to a place we've not been ourselves, so we have to have that lifestyle of worship. We need to have a fluid and growing knowledge of God's Word. We have to stay in that and let that inform all that we do. And realize disciple-making can be broad and it can be narrow. So we're talking about disciple-making here that's beyond that of providing a diet for our congregation. It's more of those relational kinds of things. And it takes regular and quality time in working with our folks. And there's several ways we can do that as worship leaders. We can have one-on-one time of teaching. We find somebody that we can mentor in ways, and it's not anything necessarily musical at all. Secondly, a weekly small group, 3 to 4 people. Again, this isn't based around a particular musical activity at all, but it's something that's just devoted to discipleship that we can be involved in. When we have our large choirs or instrumental groups, we need to take that time to disciple our people, to talk about the words of the songs, to do other things to speak into their lives. Weekly worship team, praise band, or vocal leadership team. Here we're beginning to get a small group, and think about how we can intentionally disciple these people in our times of rehearsal. I know that's a real difficult thing because you need the time for rehearsal, but you also need the time to help disciple them in other ways. And then if you have children's choirs, youth ensembles, those can be fantastic ways to disciple young people. So when we get to the place we don't feel there's time for discipleship, we need to reevaluate our priorities. It's imperative that replication is a goal, where with one being discipled, with them disciple others. And that's stuff you get in a lot of these other breakouts that we have here. But as worship pastors, we need to be thinking about this too, that we don't leave that just to the other folks. We disciple on grand scale as we lead in worship, and we just disciple in relations in these other ways. Let me pray, and then we'll take a few moments. Father, I just thank you for this wonderful, wonderful time that we have had to share among each other. Father, I've learned a lot from folks as they've talked, as they've shared their hearts. I pray that we would make it a priority in our lives as pastors, worship leaders, to lead our people in worship that lifts up the gospel, that helps people deal with the realities of life, that helps people come to face with who you are and all that you mean in our lives. Help us to keep pride out of the way. Help us to truly do what you've called us to do. I pray that this time we've had together maybe has helped reinforce or to maybe motivate us in some different ways that we can help our congregations to truly worship. Father, we give you all the glory and all the praise. In Christ's name, amen.